Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I feel like I have a big imagination. Mm-hmm. And I, as a young kid, obviously had an imagination. I think every single human on the planet has an imagination. But
beyond.
There, for me, it's always been culture and art and music and film that has inspired and increased and expanded my imagination and the capacity for that imagination to grow into sort of something quite positive, I think, because art, particularly the art of today's guest, can change people's lives and make them feel seen and bring people together and also reveal a kind of interior world, like a more psychological state that often, just walking down the street when you see people, sometimes they're in their own world. And today's guest makes paintings that are so special because they present that kind of unconscious moment, you know, that the moment when you don't realize you're being looked at, these
unguarded,
very private worlds. Yeah. And we are talking to her all the way from America, and her work depicts black everyday people from America, and it's very much about being American and being an everyday, you know, person living in America right now. And often these everyday people, particularly the black everyday people that she's found and sourced in a way, almost a bit like a scout, you know, looking for models somehow, you know, on the street. Maybe it's on the subway, maybe it's like, I don't know, in a diner, like eating lunch. But she spots people that she could imagine being, you know, figures in her paintings. And I just love the way that journey happens. And then the paintings themselves become these historical artifacts in a way that will live on beyond all of our lifetimes. And during our lifetime, actually change the way that people see themselves, because there's representation in galleries, in museums, because a lot of her paintings are now straight to museums as well, which is quite an unusual and extraordinary thing to happen in someone's lifetime. I love that it's happening for her. So we've been meaning to do this episode for about 2 whole years, and finally we've done it. And it's on the occasion of an amazing new exhibition that opens in October, which is going to be during Frieze London, and it's at Hauser & Wirth Gallery, and it opens in October and will run until the end of the year. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Amy Sherald. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm happy to be here with you both.
Yeah, it's been two years in the making, so we're thrilled as well. I'm in New York and you're also in New York, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm right across the river. I'm looking at New York right now through my window here.
How long have you been based in New York, because you're not born there?
No, I'm not. And my partner reminds me of that every time I tell him to cut the TV off. And he's like, cut it off? You turn it off. And I'm like, we're from the South. We cut stuff on and we cut it off and you have to cut it out. I moved here in 2018 from Baltimore, where I had been for almost 15 years, if not a year or two more. And before that, I was in Georgia, where I was born, in Atlanta, where I went to college, and was born in Columbus, Georgia. So I've just been making my way up the East Coast since I was born.
What is it about New York as a destination for you? And do you feel like this is, not to say final destination, that sounds quite ominous, but do you feel like this is somewhere where you're going to be, you feel really settled and you feel really creative?
I do feel really creative here. It was never a destination to me, for me, because I realized shortly after grad school that had I moved up here, I would have never made it as an artist. I feel like it would have been to my detriment rather than to my benefit to be up here, because so much of what you have to put your energy towards is like about work, having to pay for a studio, having to pay for an apartment. It's like, when is there going to be time to be in the studio? So I specifically chose to stay in Baltimore and make Baltimore my office, because my rent was $400 a month, you know, for my studio. I could work in a restaurant and make the money I needed to put all my energy towards making my work. So New York was like a dream that I realized was like a false reality that I couldn't exist in. One day, I took a trip up here one day. I was at Pace Gallery for, I don't know whether you remember when he had the exhibition, it's been a long time, where they were like playing cards, over 10 years ago. And I went to the opening and I was standing around and I realized in that moment, like, it's just me and a bunch of other artists in this room. Like, nobody important is in this room that's going to change my life and like make my dreams come true. And I saw somebody go back through one of those like invisible doors that they have in the wall, you know, where it's no handle, you just kind of push. And I'm like, that's the room I need to be in. And I'm not in that room. Like, I'm wasting my time. So I just really started focusing on what was happening in the studio at that point, because I realized that if I did that, then the opportunity would find itself. So love brought me to New York, but not work.
Right. Well, it's quite an inspiring story that you have the wherewithal at that point to go, that's where I need to get to, but I'm going to keep funding my practice because that's what's important now, rather than location. And you did that, you said, by waiting tables. So I guess your trajectory into the art world, because people looking at you now see you are an incredibly successful, you know, barometer, like amazing artist that people are referencing. And as Rob said, you're in museum collections, but it's not been a smooth kind of trip into the art world from education straight into representation.
Right. It has not.
But looking back at that, has that given you more tools for your practice?
You know, it kept me in a really desperate place. And I think that that was a good thing, because I feel as if had I gotten too comfortable, I wouldn't have strived so hard and so much for so long. Cause like, you know, you hit your 30s and it's like a different life after that. Like, you want different things and it's really hard to stay focused and not give up. And then you hit your 40s and you're like, okay, this is some bullshit. You know, like, what's really going on here? But I think that I made sure that I wasn't comfortable. I made sure that I wasn't happy with where I was in my life on purpose. You know, I didn't want to be in a place where I could possibly just give up and stay there. So dog walkers coming to pick up George Weasley.
No, but the dogs is a huge thing for me with you. The fact that you, we may as well talk about it because we're going to keep the dogs in because this is genius. The fact that you have a dog Instagram already makes me just feel like you're the most perfect person ever.
I do a really poor job of running it too. But yeah, okay, so what was I saying before all this?
Dogs over. Yeah, making yourself uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, so I put myself in a place where I couldn't give up, because if I gave up, I don't know what else I would have done. Like, I know I didn't want to be a waitress for the rest of my life. And being a wine sommelier sounded like a good idea, but like, would I have been able to pass the test? Like, who knows, you know? So I really only gave myself one option. And I think that's something that's really important when it comes to having a dream and making it come true. It's like, it has to be your sole focus in life.
Mm-hmm. Where does that self-belief come from? Because it's inspiring to hear. And I'm sure many people listening will feel like they want to give up or they're not getting where they want to be at a certain time in their life. How do you hold on to that self-belief through all that?
I don't know. I think it's a healthy place. You're kind of straddling. How do I say this? I don't know. Like, you kind of have to believe that you're better than you really are in a way, because if you look at reality and like just see everything in black and white, it may not seem possible. So for me, like, I almost had to have a false sense of self-esteem and a belief in myself that, you know, it's not really warranted at the time. You know, I mean, I still look back and I don't even know how I got into graduate school with the work that I had at the time, but I made it in and I worked the hardest. I think I'm just like a really hard worker, and I'm a natural born fighter as well. Like, I just don't have a weak constitution. I'm very comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I think in order to pursue something that's not empirical, you have to be one of those people that's comfortable being uncomfortable, you know? Mm. That's really important. And then really, I don't know. I mean, I meditated every day. I manifested everything that I feel like I wanted in my life just by envisioning it. It really is true. Like, people are like, how'd you do it? I'm like, I sat down every day and I saw myself in a white box with a concrete floor that was a gallery in New York City, until it was so real that I just would like tear up, you know what I mean? Like, I just would feel it. And then I would get up and start painting again.
And actually, talking about New York, I read somewhere that you didn't want to exhibit in New York until it was like the right time. So you kind of exhibited like loads of other places. You kind of built up your career. And then when the time was right, which meant you got a space where it was going to be like impactful and kind of
the manifestation. You
know, have, yeah, the manifestation. Yeah. But I even loved that, that kind of determination to make sure where your work is being seen is the right location for it as well.
Yeah, there is a level of desperation, but then you also have to recognize that every opportunity isn't an opportunity. And that goes back to like me thinking that I was better than I was, because like, who was I? Like, nobody knew who I was, but I'm like, I want my first New York show to be like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it, you know, one great thing about being a late bloomer is that you have the opportunity to watch other people's lives unfold. And if you're smart, you're taking notes, you know? And, you know, I've been a fly on a wall and, you know, heard conversations and, you know, I kind of slowly began to realize that that first introduction to the New York art market is your most important first introduction ever, right? And if it's not done right, then you could end up being that, you know, boy or girl that everybody's already dated first. And so like, you kind of, you know what I'm saying?
It's
like
sloppy seconds, we call it, yeah.
Right, like there's a mystique, I think, that galleries are attracted to. I don't know, I really don't know, but I think there's a right way to go about it, and there's a wrong way to go about it. And I decided that that was the right way for me, was to like wait until it was going to be a big moment. And I was hoping for that, and I'm just like, you know, lucky that it worked out that way.
Can we go back to Columbus, Georgia? Because I have spent the last week with two twins who grew up in Alabama, but on the kind of border with Columbus. And they
Are they from Phoenix City, Alabama?
I can't remember where they're from now. Seal, Alabama, I think. So the artists I was with are called Jarrett and John Key, and they grew up in Seal, but they used to go across to Columbus to do their like theater classes, their performance classes, their art lessons, all that kind of stuff. And when they heard I was interviewing you, they completely freaked out because they were like, we love her. Like, we've heard how generous she is to like other artists who have come from Columbus. And apparently there's a young painter, I think recently moved to New York, and you've just had him in your studio or something. And they were like, they adore you anyway. And they were saying what an incredible place Columbus was. So I'd never even really thought much about Columbus before. And it's really interesting to me that so many great artists have come out of it. You know, if you think of Beau Bartlett, who I know inspired you, and like yourself and all these other people. So can you talk a bit about... Yes, exactly. Yes, big time. So can you speak a bit about what, you know, Columbus and why it's such a special creative place?
I would never call it that. That's so funny they call it that. I was like, I can't wait to get out of here.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
It's funny, I mean, but I was there in a different time. Like, so I was born in 1973, right? I'm almost 50 years old. So when I was growing up there, you know, there was a lot, it was a different city. I think it's still a lot of the same city, like having just driven through there 2 days ago and seeing how all the development in the city is happening at the north of the city, like it's divided by Macon Road. And what's south of Macon Road is brown and black, and there's just, they've almost given up on that side of the city, and everything is happening up north, even though Fort Benning, which is one of the largest army bases in America, is like south of the city. So I have very mixed feelings about Columbus, Georgia. It's where I'm from, and growing up in the deep south really influenced who I was as a person, how I thought about myself. And I don't think I'd be making this work had I not been born there. Mm-hmm. And lived through those kinds of experiences, and, you know, coming back and then realizing that I really didn't know who I was, because I felt like I'd been performing my whole life and trying to assimilate and make other people feel comfortable. And then coming to New York, and it's culturally like 1,000% different, right? It's like people are straightforward. It's just a different, two different worlds. And I like myself better up here than I do down there. Like I feel like I always project. I'm just like projecting on people when I'm down there. So like maybe it's different, but when I left, it wasn't very different. So I just think there's a certain kind of white person there that I'm sure they are there, but it's probably not as saturated as it was back in the 70s. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
I mean, my art teacher, Jerry Davis, was my everything. And so she was like my art scene, right? From like kindergarten to 12th grade, this woman was like, you know, my introduction to everything, because there wasn't much going on there as far as arts is concerned. I mean, my mom and dad went to plays, and my dad was really into jazz, but outside of the Columbus Museum, I didn't know much else, and I only went there once, you know.
This was on a school trip. Did she take you there?
Yeah, she took us there on that school trip to see Beau Bartlett's exhibition. And after that, I didn't go to a museum again until I was in college. So it's an interesting place. But I know they've thrived there. Tony, who is their friend, he's thrived there. But then you also hit a ceiling where, like, you have to get out. You just kind of have to go. It's a small town. Like, you just kind of have to go.
Yeah,
you
know? for sure.
If you want to become what you want to become.
Yeah.
And that trip as a teenager to the Columbus Museum kind of opened your mind to what art could be, and that it could be an opportunity for you.
Yeah, I didn't even know what it, you know, I just knew it was something I was always drawn to. I just didn't want to be, I wanted to be different. Like, I think that was my first attraction to it. You know, I always liked to draw because I was introverted and, you know, very shy and self-conscious. So being drawing and that kind of stuff I could do in my room by myself was like my own little piece of heaven. But outside of that, you know, being raised in a small town like that, I was always looking at people like Cyndi Lauper and Boy George and, like, you know, these like punk rock kids. And I was like, these people are so cool, because it was an expression of self that I had never really seen in real life. And so they were artists to me. And that's, you know, what I was striving for, and just wanting to be cool. You know, I mean, all these things like kind of feed into each other in a way where, you know, like once you get older, you realize that being an artist doesn't mean that you dress cool. But when you're younger, it's like artists like have blue hair, and they, like, you know, they have piercings and tattoos.
Did you have a time where you felt like you had to dress like an artist, parentheses? Did you feel like I need to be cool. I need to like assimilate a look for myself.
I did. As soon as I escaped my mother's grasp, as soon as I left Columbus, Georgia and landed in Atlanta, I swear within 2 months, I had shaved my head. I had a piercing. I had a LeBray. I had $80. I went and got like a tattoo. I'm like paying to get removed right now. And, you know, I just needed to become who I wanted to be in my head. You know, and that's part of the journey. It's just like having the courage to just be different, because nobody was different where I was from. Everything was black and white. Nobody was Jewish. Nobody was gay. Like, it was just black and white people existing together, and everybody was Christian. And you know what I mean? There wasn't a lot of diversity or variety and and how to be a person.
I totally relate to that. Like where I'm from in Essex, which is basically Jersey to Manhattan, I guess is a way of describing it, is that as a gay man, I also, and as an actor and obsessed with, you know, theater and art galleries, I couldn't be the person I needed to be or wanted desperately to be if I stayed at home. I had to get into London. And that was no disrespect where I was from, but it just didn't, it was too containing. Like you said, you hit a ceiling and you're like, I can see it's glass and there's all this other stuff going on. I've got to get over there. So I completely relate to that. And I think a lot of artists, creative people do have to leave where they're from to release their inner creativity.
I always think of Detroit as well. Like if you think of certain places that were outside of the kind of, you know, New York City or Hollywood or LA, or you know what I mean? Like the kind of the big cities, like Detroit was always a place where I saw loads of musicians coming out of, and they almost had to like invent themselves even bigger than like the acts that would have come out straight out of New York. So if you think of like Iggy Pop or like Madonna or just different people. But even for me growing up in England, like Cyndi Lauper was such a visionary human. Like I loved everything about her.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. But you also spent a lot of time in Panama, no, when you were growing up, because I read that sort of had a big impact in the way that you see color and the way that you potentially, like, you know, think about the world.
Yeah, well, once I graduated from college and left Columbus behind, you know, I've been gifted mentors throughout my life, and so, like, for each stage practically. So my painting instructor at Spelman College was from Panama, and he started an artist colony there. So I got to spend a lot of my summers there. And, you know, it was my introduction to the African diaspora. It was the second country that I got to visit. So in high school, we went to Mexico, but this was the first country that I was able to visit where there were Black people there that, you know, had a different kind of experience than I did. And I think, you know, I had this one moment when, because of where I was from, everything was black and white. And we were, I think we were going to drive back into Panama City or something like that. But I was like, where are the Black clubs at? And they're like, what are you talking about? You know, it's like their world, and their identity was very different than my Southern identity. And that's, you know, it was like a real learning moment for me there. But, you know, we did a lot of painting and everything is, you know, all the houses are painted different colors. The artists that Arturo was working with that are from Portobello, Panama, you know, they're men now, but they were young children when we first visited, and they're self-taught and they make these gorgeous paintings, these gorgeous portraits of beautiful colors and broken mirror around the edges to ward off the evil spirits. I mean, it's a really magical place, but you're really consumed by the colors that you see in the village, along with it, the fact that it sits in a port that's, you know, you're looking out into the ocean, you'll see a dolphin every now and then. And then there's this, you know, history of it being a slave port. And these, you know, my friends ended up there because their ancestors were able to, you know, fight off the Spaniards and like run into the jungle. And they, you know, it's a wonderful legacy. And I feel really lucky that I was able to spend time there, but it definitely, you know, when I think about my use of color and how I really came into thinking about it in that way, it was definitely from having the opportunity to spend time there.
Have you always been drawn to the figure? Because you said when you were studying, your work was very different. Has the figure always been present?
Yeah, that's all I really know. I mean, I don't know anything else. There was nothing else to know when I said I wanted to be an artist. It was like, artists paint people. That's all I really knew, because I didn't know who Andy Warhol was or any of these other guys. So, but I think if I had a choice, I don't think I would change it, because as you know, as as introverted as I am, it's a way for me to interact with people without actually like interacting with people. But I'm also an empath, and I'm always curious about the, you know, like the psychological makeup of different people and their stories and how their narratives are developed, and just, you know, who we are as individuals. I just think we're just really interesting. And I, for me, it's like my goal to capture that, you know, the psychology of each person that I paint with my paintbrush.
Well, I think people coming to your work will recognize many things or see many things, but predominantly for me, it's how well-dressed all of your people are, and also this very distinctive gray skin tone, which the characters have. Where did they come from, and how important is fashion for you?
The grisaille came from, you know, just a process. Like, art making is a process. And I was postgraduate school pursuing a body of work, like trying to figure out the body of work that I was going to make for the rest of my life. And it was like a process of deduction, really. Like, I had started to make paintings in grisaille before I placed the skin color on
top.
What
is grisaille for people that are listening? Sorry.
It's a way of painting in grayscale, basically. I usually just say grayscale, and then people write about my work and they're like, grisaille. So I'm like, well, maybe I should say grisaille too. But it's really just grayscale. I'm like,
it's a bit sassier. Yeah, I like it.
I'm not that fancy. So yeah, it's really just grayscale. And I just thought that it looked really stunning. Like, you know, once I finished my first piece like that, I just thought it looked really stunning with being surrounded by color. And, you know, I always tell the story of just having a fear in a way of painting the black figure, and then just having the conversation around the work be marginalized, because I didn't want to try to produce something that was bigger than just that conversation. And so I think looking back, that was part of the reason why I made that decision. Because even if I painted them purple, like, they still be black people. It doesn't take away from, you know, who we are. Our skin color is always, it's just, that's just is what it is. But I think, you know, to look at a painting and that not be the first thing that you see, you know, could start a different kind of conversation.
And the clothes.
And the fashion. Yeah. I mean, thinking about it, it was, I never really considered it fashion, but I'm thinking about like the first painting that I made, that when I really understood like what I was doing with these. And I think what the clothes bring into the work for me is just it's a way to separate these people from the crowd almost. And, you know, I've had some really wonderful opportunities to find pieces of clothing that like tell a story just by what they have on them, like a house with a sweater with like houses on it. Or, you know, I did this one painting that had a lobster and a sun. I mean, those kind of things are the kind of things that I look for, because then the whole painting can speak to different things. Like, you can have a conversation with the shirt or the person. It's like,
but they're real items of clothing every time. Do you always have to work from life and with a real model, or can you ever imagine these people and what they're wearing?
No, I can't. Well, I mean, sometimes I say I see people that are already, you know, that are already in my imagination, but maybe I really don't have an imagination, because I really like to work from life. Like, I'm not one of those people that can, like, I guess I could do it, but I never tried. I don't know. But I like to see somebody, take a picture of them after I figure out how I want to dress them, and then make the painting. I never was like a make believe. I guess there's a difference between like painting people that you meet and then people that you make up. I think for me, it feels more authentic for it to be a person that I've seen and touched and dressed than
what is that process that then? What is that process? Will you approach someone and go like, "You look great. Can you put on this lobster sweater? Let me take a photograph."
Yeah, because I've actually seen like clothing rails.
Oh yeah,
like
Rob wants your sweaters.
Yeah,
but I love.
I collect
that.
Clothes I, now. I do.
Yeah,
I collect them because you never know. You know, if I find something and I like it, then I have to get it. But I mean, I normally just walk up to people. Sometimes it's really hard for me to do that, and you know, I have to like take a deep breath. And then be like, okay, just like say hello. But that's pretty much how it happens. Like I just, you know, see a person and I'm like, if I don't do this, I'm going to regret it because I've seen a person and not done it. And I like 10 years later, I'm still regretting not painting that person.
Really?
It's not like I make a whole bunch of paintings, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. But do you have like,
I think it's,
sorry, but are you then walking around permanently with your camera and are you always on work or can you like experience the world without thinking, oh, there's someone over there who'd be great for a painting. Give me 5 minutes. I'm just going to go and do this. You have your cup of coffee on your own. I just need to take a picture. There must be a thing, I guess, for anybody, creative writers, whatever, you just feel like any moment you go, oh, that's an amazing line. That's a great scene. This is a great image. Does it disrupt
that's how
your,
it is. That's how
that
it
is how it is.
Yeah, it's funny because my partner, Kevin, I was picking him up from the PATH station one day and he gets into the car and I lean over to give him a hug and I open my eyes and there's this guy leaning on the wall on the other side, you know, like through our window smoking a cigarette. And I'm like, I'll be right back. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, you didn't even kiss me yet. And I just like literally had to go get this guy. He ended up being the guy in the painting with the lobster and the sun. Like it was... He was just perfect.
But what's he like?
My eyeballs are always on.
Do you ever have people that refuse, or do you have to turn on the charm completely? Have you ever had moments where you're that they step away from you, go, "I'm not interested at all, lady"?
No.
No, great.
I had one person do that, and she was like a young girl, like maybe 17, and she worked at the drugstore in my local neighborhood in Baltimore, and she was just like, "Nah." I begged her for a year and change.
Do you show people like examples of your paintings and stuff?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. To kind of like show them that you're legit. Yeah. Really? Like, she was not having it. Like, yeah. Oh.
Do you work from sketches and then go into paintings?
No, my sketches is what I'm shooting through the viewfinder. I've never been a sketcher, unfortunately. I used to get in trouble for not turning in my sketchbooks in college, but I don't find it fulfilling at all to sketch. I don't know why. I wish I did. Yeah, I get my camera and I spend an hour, maybe 2 hours with the model. And those are my sketches, like the 150 plus photographs that I take of this one person. Those are the sketches. And then I go through those and I, you know, look for these little details that I, you know, that I think are important. And sometimes it can just be as small as, you know, the way they're holding their mouth or whether, you know, their hand is positioned a certain way and like what kind of change of emotion that brings to the painting, little things like that. But the photograph is the sketch.
I watched a film of you working with a model that you met somewhere and it was Alice in Wonderland themed and she's holding a kind of a teacup and in that film you were talking about how you really wanted her head to move a certain way and her shoulder to relax in a certain way and there was this idea of like somehow I think the phrase was a relief from the political, so somehow like the paintings themselves can allow a space for the black body to no longer, you know, solely be a political thing. It can be this kind of relief. And I found it so strong, that visual of this, because you can really see it in that her pose, you know, holding that teacup. And the final painting, it's just got this dignity and this elegance, but also this kind of magical element to it, a kind of dreamlike, you know, Alice in Wonderland kind of fantastical element.
Well, it's a competition winner as well, that painting. That was
a
big prize.
It was the beginning of the beginning. Yeah.
But can you speak a bit about that relief from the political? Because I sort of loved that as a phrase, really.
Yeah, it's God, I did that one in like 2014 or 2015. And I think for me, that painting was really about letting go of that kind of self-awareness that, you know, I felt like I grew up with in the South, or what I had to have, or what my mom taught me to, how my mom taught me to be self-aware. And I think that goes back to the conversation about assimilation, where you're watching yourself being watched. You know, I remember reading this book by this writer named John Berger, and he sees it as an attribute that women have, but I think we all have it. And he gave an example of a woman getting up in a restaurant where, you know, she's going out to dinner and she's dressed up and she's walking to the restroom. And when you're walking with your heels and everything, like, you have a camera in your mind that's playing back what you think other people are seeing when they look at you. And I think, like, you know, moving through the world as a Black person can feel that way sometimes. Less, like I said, I feel differently about myself in New York. And that's one of the things that I don't really think about up here that I think about down there, because I know that white people see Black differently down there. And I think their interactions with me are based on preconceived notions that I automatically feel like I have to prove them to be different than what they think, right? So that one, that Unsuppressed Deliverance, which is the parenthetical title, is what I was thinking about when I came up with that idea for that piece. I think that's, it brought me back to that time in my life when I was living in Columbus.
So this was a National Portrait Gallery competition winner in 2016. And this, you were saying, was the beginning of the beginning, it felt like, for you. And it financially gave you a boost, and it also probably gave you an ego boost, and it gave you self-esteem boost, and all of these things that every artist is looking for. Mm-hmm. Did you feel it at the time, like, okay, we're off, strap yourselves in?
Yeah, I was at a precipice at that point where I knew I needed, you know, I had finally quit waiting tables, and I was like, you know, living off of little or nothing. And I knew I needed that next breakthrough to happen, but I didn't know how it was going to happen. And it was exactly that, you know, like, you're falling into darkness, and then all of a sudden the next thing comes and, like, lifts you up. And then you're like, okay, like, this still is a possibility. Like, I can still do this. So it was a financial boost, because I literally didn't have any money, like, at that time, you know. And I knew I needed all $25,000 to, like, pay back my rent, because I hadn't paid my rent in 3 months. But I was also kind of like in an artist residency, so they weren't going to kick you out, but
it was pressure,
you know. Yeah, my rent was like $700 a month, but it is a residency, right? So it's like they're giving you below market price rent for and a live work space. And so I think they, you know, they worked with me because they felt like I was going to be doing something. So it just worked out. Like, I already had all the math done on, like, what I was going to do if I won $25,000, $10,000, $5,000, $1,000, whatever. And I really wasn't expecting it to happen, to be honest. Like, it just wasn't on my radar that I would even, you know, you apply to these obligatory things like these portrait competitions and whatnot, because it's just what you do. You know, you have a list of things that you apply to every year, most painters, and that was just one of them. And I remember bitching about having to spend $50 on doing it, because I was like, this is like a waste of my money. Like, they're making all this money because all these artists are going to apply, and, like, you know, blah, 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 blah. But it was the best $50 ever spent.
That went into the National Portrait Gallery collection by winning the competition.
It is not, who has that painting? So no, my, one of my very close friends, her father bought that painting like before I even applied to the competition. So it belongs to the North Carolina Museum of Art. Like, they donated it to that museum.
Oh, nice. Oh, wow.
But the, you know, the reward for winning that competition is the commission by the National Portrait Gallery. So that's like, they're paying you $25,000 to do this commission. But mine
my commission ended up being Michelle Obama.
Well, let's talk about
that. Which was unexpected too. Like I was like, you know, I was like, I'm going to paint Colin Powell. I want to paint Serena Williams and Venus. Like I already had this whole idea of like what this painting was going to look like with them on this tennis court and the whole nine. But that wasn't in the stars.
So this was literally a year later, this came in and you were like personally selected by the Obamas and you had a choice when you went in to meet them that you could choose either to paint the first lady or the former president. And you went straight to the first lady. No disrespect. I want to paint you, Michelle. What was that process like? And also, I've also read that you do work from photography, but oil paints are not allowed in the White House. This is something that Sharon Sprung, who's just done a painting now, said that you're not allowed to take them in. So you have to be an artist that is able to work from photography.
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. I mean, they told me casually that they had submitted my name along with like 20 other artists for the competition. And I was like, cool, 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 cool. didn't really think anything of it. And then they're like, oh, by the way, you got shortlisted. I'm like, great, 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 great. And then they're like, okay, so actually they want you to come to the White House because they're going to interview all five of you in the Oval Office. And I'm like, okay, good, good. Okay. And I really didn't know what to think. I mean, I didn't know what to think. I just, you know, I was in DC and in true Amy fashion, I was like, 5 minutes late for the meeting. Like, who does that?
Oh no, 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 no. No, 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 no. That is horrible. No, 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 no. That makes me cringe. Oh my God.
So they let another, I called them and I was like, look, there's a little traffic here in DC right now. I'm making my way there. And so they let the other artist go first. I know, can you believe it? I wasn't even trying to. I'm just like really bad with that. I don't know. Later on in life is one of my vices. So I got there and was waiting to be called in because the other artists had gone ahead of me. And when I walked in, Brock walked towards me and he's like, you know, nice to meet you. And I'm like, it's almost like a shock to see somebody that you've only seen. I've seen other people though. I've seen other people in real life that I've seen on television, but something about seeing President Obama was like completely different. And you know, I blame it on the lights also in the Oval Office because it's backlit around the crown molding and it's just really bright compared to the rest of the White House, which is, it's, you know, this kind of light that makes everything look dingy, at least in the waiting room where we were, because I guess it was like fluorescent and yellow. But I've never frozen before in my life, but I froze for about 3 seconds because I felt like I couldn't tell whether I was like, this was really happening or was it like not happening? And I was like dreaming that it was happening. And then I snapped out of it and he made this joke. He says, you know, you look like you got the memo. And I'm like, memo, 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 like what, you know? And I didn't realize that we all had on the same color. Like we all woke up that morning and decided to put on taupe. So I'm like, you know, got that like 35 seconds too late, you know? But yeah, we had a great conversation and, you know, I think I walked in there very differently than I would have in any other situation involving any other president because it was the first Black president and first lady. And so there's a different sense of ownership and belonging that you have because of that. And I didn't feel like I needed to be self-conscious because, you know, there's also a knowing that they have too. Yeah. Of you, you know, so it felt really great to experience that in the White House, in a place like the Oval, you know, that's the history of the White House is, you know, just as Michelle said, it was built by slaves. So it was just a really once in a lifetime, even if I hadn't gotten the commission, like just having that opportunity to sit down and chat with them was good enough. But I didn't feel like I had come that far not to get it either. So,
but you knew you wanted to paint Michelle over Barack.
I did. I mean, when they approached me, it was about Michelle. So I didn't really realize I was being interviewed for both, but she was always my focus anyway. And then while we were having conversations, Barack had asked me a couple of questions, you know, he's like, well, how would you paint me? And I'm like, actually, I have no idea, because I didn't even think about you as a model in my head, you know. But Michelle was like, no, don't. This is good right here. Like, this is good. You know, so she just like, this is my girl. Yeah. And then I found out I got it 2-3 months later.
So you were in an audition process with the other artists in the waiting room. What, I mean, were you all...
They didn't want us to know who each other. So I didn't know that the other artist was leaving. I didn't see them when they were leaving.
Do you know who they are now?
Yeah. Well, no. Now I know who that one was, and I guess I can't say it still. I'll tell you off after this conversation. I had never met
everyone listening is so frustrated right now.
It's a talk out exclusive.
Because everything about this thing was so secretive. Like, Sharon talks about having to keep that secret for 6 years. I have no idea how it worked out. We only had to keep it for 1.5 years, and the donors were so excited that one of the donors leaked it before it was, you know, it was supposed to be leaked like the day before the unveiling, and it got leaked, what, like 4 months before, something like that. So, it's crazy that 6 years later, they're just like, you know, here's Sharon Sprung, and like nobody knew about it. Cause my mom was telling people, I mean, I told 3 people, but my mom was telling like all of her friends. And luckily, like, you know, they're in Columbus. So it's like, who are they going to tell? But,
if you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, so Sharon Sprung and Robert McCurdy have done the official White House portraits, which, as you were saying, took 6 years to get in there because the former administration of Trump did not want the portraits in the White House, and they had to be kept secret for that long. And as you said, that is a game-changing moment in your career. Absolutely, that painting. And for them to deny the artists and also, you know, the representation within the White House of that time just speaks volumes for, you know, their ethics and morals.
But it was insane. It was insane. And to think that if he had gotten in, if he was voted in another 4 years, like, it would have been another 4 years.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what they would have done. Maybe they would have done something differently, but that must have been really frustrating for them.
I remember the first time I saw the portrait that you did of Michelle and just thinking I'd never seen her in that way before, because in a way, because your usual subjects are everyday people, you know, people who, you know, work around the corner in a shop or, you know, just are everyday people. Like, it sort of for the first time made me see her in a really personal way, in a way that was kind of unguarded and like, and almost like a friend or something, you know, like, and I've always loved her, but I've always kind of had her up on a pedestal with someone like, I don't know, Princess Diana or something, you know, like she's kind of dreamlike to me. But your portrait, of course, she's dignified, elegant, you know, stunning in it, but there's a friendliness, a kind of openness, a kindness, a gentleness, which I just think you know, is unique to the way that you are able to portray people in your paintings. Like, was that something you were really obviously thinking about?
I really was, because I wanted not to give the world an image that they had already seen before. And then also, like, who you, that energy that you pick up from her in the portrait is who she really is in real life, you know? Not on the world stage. She's, you know, not, I mean, she kind of is like an everyday person, right? Like, she married Barack Obama, he ended up being president, but, you know, she's extraordinary in her own right. But when you meet her and you're around her, you know, she's like, I'm just Michelle from the South Side. And that's exactly who I wanted to capture.
Mm. Well, the original title was Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama. And then it changed to First Lady Michelle Obama. But again, I guess that is you channeling through the titling that she is, you know, Michelle from where she's from.
Yeah.
The National Portrait Gallery recorded unprecedented public response. It had doubled the attendance figures when the portrait was there. People were queuing around the block to get in to see the portrait. What was that moment like for you? And did you feel then in that moment, oh, I might have arrived now. This is, you know, we're off.
Yeah.
Or are you still processing it now? I mean, it's such a huge thing and it still is.
After the National Portrait Gallery competition and like winning that and then having my first solo show at my first gallery in Chicago less than a year later, and then having this like waiting list, which is like makes you feel really hopeful about your career, and then having the portrait unveiled and that kind of what I call like a crossover boost, because it wasn't that portrait isn't exactly about the art world and the things that happen in it, but it's about, you know, her and Barack and like what they mean to not only Americans, but, you know, people that live all over the world. Like I got emails from Italy and like all these different places where, you know, they become emotionally invested in who they are and what they represent. Mm-hmm. But it was really, for me, like the first 72 hours was like just ridden with anxiety kind of, because you have to prepare yourself for not only the praise, but the criticism. Mm. And
was there criticism?
There was some, yeah, because a lot of people didn't understand why she was gray, you know? And I'm like, did you not see, like, you know, it's like, I was at my house this past weekend because I was there with Annie Leibovitz and she was photographing me, and we were having a conversation about like the Simone Biles cover and how the image is like, she kind of darkens her images. And I'm like, you know, there was this big uproar and I'm like, I guess nobody like looked at the past 20 years of your work, you know, but it's the same thing. It's like, this is what I do. She knew what I did, which is why she chose me. Like there's a bigger conversation to be had here about this. And that was really enthralling at the same time, because so many people that weren't interested in art became interested, had opinions and were engaging and wanted to see it. And I got like emails that were like, I hate it. And then one woman emailed me that she hated it. And then 2 months later, she actually got to see it in person. And she was like, oh my God, it made me cry. It's so beautiful. And because you can't really look at a painting on social media or on the internet and like get the full grasp of like what it is the artist is trying to portray.
It's a scale as well. This is like a 1.8 meter by 1.5 meter portrait. You don't get that from an image on your iPhone. Do you know what I mean? Or from a newspaper. So you do need to stand in front of these.
I always remember
things.
the video as well, because there was a video unveiling where they kind of, you know, took the cloth off the painting, and it felt so theatrical in a way. And it's such an unusual way to like first see a painting, that even that moment you sort of judge something quite harshly or quite positively.
Well, you said you'd forgotten.
Super immediately, like as an
audience. You'd forgotten what it looked like. I think I read you saying that when you saw it in front of you, you were like, oh, that's not how I remembered it.
It's like, that's how I felt when I saw it at the Brooklyn Museum, because I hadn't seen it in so long. that I got to see it again for the first time. And, you know, I'm oftentimes self-deprecating. And so when I say this, I'm not like saying it like I think I probably should be saying it that way, like Issa Rae. But I was like, wow, this really is a good painting. Like I was kind of surprised, you know, like pleasantly surprised that I'm like, this is it's got something there that's special about it. But yeah, when it was first unveiled, yeah, it was, I don't know, I just wanted to run to the bathroom. Like I've always want to run to the bathroom, but somebody got a screenshot of it when there was like a glare over it, and then like that went around Twitter. And everybody's like, doesn't look like her. It looks like Sasha or somebody or Malia. And I was like, there's a glare on the painting. Like, you can't even really see it. So that was like my 24-hour nightmare, was like the fact that somebody posted a picture of it with a glare on it where you couldn't even really see her face at all. And then people started talking about it.
You had a great response to the public, the negativity, where you said that some people like their poetry to rhyme and some people don't. And I've actually written that down as one of like my mantras. I have a list of mantras of people. And I think that is such a beautiful way of just looking at anything, you know, because you're never going to please everyone.
No, you're not. And if everybody likes it, I feel like something's wrong with it. You know what I mean? It's not a cartoon. Like, this is real life stuff. You know what I mean? So I think the fact that people wanted to have conversations about it and were debating about whether they like gray skin or brown skin or what the gray skin did or did not signify, or whether it allowed her to be black or took away her blackness, you know, all those things are really great. And I think that's what makes a great piece of art. It's like you can form opinions and have different opinions about it, because that's the complexity of the work. It's, you know,
I know that since that moment, you've had solo exhibitions at places like Hauser and Wirth, and you've had huge crowds attend. And I noted that the crowds, you know, that came to your show in New York were incredibly diverse groups of people as well. And I mean, like, literally people queuing around the block to see your shows. And a lot of people, including myself, who have seen your work in person, they're quite kind of awe-inspiring paintings, simply because of a formal kind of quality of skill, like the masterfulness of your brush strokes, of the way you paint. How has that developed, like, over the whole of your life, I guess? Because there seems to be this kind of aspiration to, you know, being the greatest. Like, because I honestly think the way you paint is up there with, you know, art history. Like it's just... it's awe-inspiring when you see it in real life.
You're part of the canon.
Yeah, but you are. But that's partly because of the skill, though. Do you see what I mean? It's not just the conceptual ideas behind it and the political resonance and how important all of the meaning is. The actual skill behind it. Like, is that something that you always had a natural sort of focus towards, like trying to be the best you could possibly be?
I did. I mean, it's, you know, I always, yeah. I mean, you work really hard at stuff and you get better at it. And I just, you know, it's that 10,000 hours thing where I spent 10,000 hours and, you know, you finally kind of master what it is that you're doing. I have to say, I sometimes like the way that I painted better 10 years ago than I do now, because it was a little more stylized, because my skill level was like not quite there yet. But when I look back at it, I think it's really interesting. And when I was preparing for this show coming up in London, you know, everything is like really realistic, and that's always been one of my goals. But I kind of missed that in between stage where you're good but not great, because I think something was, I really liked, you know, the way the paintings felt then for some reason. Not that these aren't, you know, not that these suck or anything, but but yeah, there's something about that I miss, that I had a conversation with myself about when I was making this work. But that's just, I think that's just the way process happens and growth happens, and, you know, as you journey through life as an artist.
How long does each painting take, and how many do you work on at once?
I work on several at once now. It used to just be one at a time, and it would take me like 1 to 2 months, depending on the size and like the, you know, whether I was painting plaid or like just a solid color. the bigger pieces. Like I had two motorcycles in this exhibition, and it took almost the whole year to finish those.
Wow.
It's, you know, lots of detail and just, yeah, it just takes time, like layers of paint and all that stuff. So, and sometimes you want to step away for a minute to look, you know, sometimes I need to like turn the painting around for a couple of weeks and then turn it back around so that I can see it with fresh eyes again. Or if I don't have time to do that, I'll bring a friend into the studio and just for her to like, or him to point out mistakes or, you know, tell me things that they think I should fix or work on or whatnot.
Where was the photograph for the bike from? Did you find that yourself or was that?
I found two guys. One of them, his name is Willie Wayne. I found him on Instagram. And then the other guy's name is Chad C5. And they're both, Willie Wayne's from Baltimore. And he rides, I guess everybody is a 12 o'clock boy that's in Baltimore. I'm not sure. But
what does that mean?
12 o'clock boys are a group of bikers that started in Baltimore probably 15, 20 years ago. I got to speak to one of the original members when I first had the idea for this painting about 4 years ago. And he's my age. He doesn't ride anymore. Or he rides like a Harley now. So I'm assuming that this started when he was a teenager. So let's just say 20 plus years ago in Baltimore. And when you ride at 12 o'clock, it means that you're popped up on a wheelie on one wheel and you're riding straight up and down. When I first moved to Baltimore for grad school, I saw these guys riding around and I was like, wow. Like I was just like, couldn't wait to see them again, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of they're considered a nuisance. I don't really see it that way. I think it's just crazy that they've taught themselves this skill that you see, like, you know, sometimes you see like 12-year-olds like riding a bike up the street with these guys. Like that part is a little scary, but they're doing it, you know. And it's like, it's a really and it's an expression of freedom and an escape at the same time from, mm-hmm. I think, just everyday life in Baltimore, in, you know, wherever they live in Baltimore, in Sandtown or East Baltimore or West Baltimore. But here, I know recently Mayor Adams like crushed like 500 bikes on the news. He like confiscated them and like a bulldozer drove over them. So they're really trying to shut them down. And I think because I spent so much time in Baltimore and it's so near and dear to my heart, I wanted to immortalize these guys and make sure that, you know, that part of American culture is also a part of art history. And I was also thinking about like paintings of men on horses and like these guys on their motorcycles and the symbolism, comparing those two ways of being in portraiture. But yeah, I've been wanting to do this painting for 5 years. So I'm really excited to put it out in the world. I'm really proud of them.
And one of the lead images from the forthcoming show in London is a couple who are in an embrace, this kind of very romantic kind of, you know, kiss. And it really struck me because a lot of your paintings, as a lot of portraits in history are, you often have that gaze, you know, like straight to the eyes. And I know that you even like position your canvases in your exhibition so that the eyes kind of meet the eyes of the viewer. And I know that installation kind of technique is really important. But can you speak a bit about making that particular painting of this sailor like kissing his loved one, where they're not, looking into the canvas, looking out of the canvas. Instead, they're just looking at each other or with their eyes closed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, that painting, can you imagine how creepy it would look if they were looking at you?
Yeah, true.
Less romantic.
That would be weird.
Or one of them has their eyes open, the other one doesn't. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, when you think about the gay kiss, I think gay kissing should be normalized. And I think this is a great way to pursue that. You know, I think it's such a, you know, people get kicked out of bars, like men kiss in bars. And then all of a sudden, you know, people that are okay with men being gay are all of a sudden not okay with them, you know, being affectionate towards one another. And they're policing, you know, love between two people. And I think that's just crazy. And so, no, they're not looking at you, but you have to look at them in this passionate, loving, intimate moment. And there's so many kisses, you know, historically speaking, outside of Gustav Klimt, that it just seemed like a great addition to my body of work.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, with the conversations that we're having now around, you know, just the right to be married and, you know, commit yourself to your loved one in a way where you can still have access to them when you need to, because that's what technically marriage is about. This is like paperwork.
Did you find this couple? Like, were they a couple or were they two men that you kind of cast and put into place?
Yeah, these two I cast and put them into place. I wasn't sure. I mean, the luck of me finding like two men that would be comfortable kissing each other. I just wanted to be able to like choose exactly who I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I used a casting agent for them.
Oh, wow.
And they were perfect. Like, they were perfect together. They were perfect for each other. I'm like, you guys should date. Like,
now they're together. Now they're together. That's hilarious.
Super hot.
That would be amazing if you actually match made like this couple, put immortalized them already, and then they go on to have a relationship. And these paintings form part of a show that you've got at Hauser & Wirth, and it's taken in London during Freeze London in October, and it's taken both the spaces on Savile Row. So there's two huge gallery spaces that you're taking over. The title is called The World We Make, and there's also going to be a beautiful monograph that's going to be published at the same time. And this is your first European exhibition. How is it feeling like for you right now, knowing that this is all going to be happening in a month's time?
It's really exciting. You know, life happens so fast that sometimes you kind of miss the moment to celebrate and just recognize and sit with your accomplishments. You know, I had a second, like literally a second yesterday, where I was waiting for some bread to toast. And I, you know, just for a second, I was like, wow, I just turned 49. And, you know, this is happening. Like, I'll be 50 next year, which for me feels like old. Like,
and you have to make your own toast. You were like, this shouldn't be where I'm at now. Someone should be doing this for me. Yeah.
But it's exciting and it's really meaningful. And, you know, it's a dream come true. And I just feel really lucky that, you know, this is my life and I get to make these paintings and put them out in the world and hopefully make the world a better place than it was when I was born into it. You know, because of the work. So I'm excited. I really am.
I was really thinking that young painters or young artists who see this show are going to be so inspired, because even in that portrait of the gay couple kissing, just the detail in the trousers, like in the pants.
Fashion students are going to be looking at your work.
No, but it's the detail, like the detailing of the actual painting of the turnover, like on the trousers. Like, it's so well painted. It's just like exquisite. I want to hug it. But I just think I think it's going to be a brilliant show for people to kind of realize that you can do anything you want in life. Like, you know, the potential within all of us for greatness and for doing positive things to create change. You know, it is possible. Like, you know, even the fact that recently, I know you donated $1 million to the University of Louisville, and like, you know, you sold a portrait that you did of Breonna Taylor, and just the significance of moments like that, you know, that you've been able to, you know, genuinely sort of socially help other people, you know, through your creativity from something that you've just started by like taking a brush and paint. And can you speak a tiny bit about that painting and also that donation?
Yeah. I mean, that things like being able to donate, you know, that money to the University of Louisville for scholarships and fellowships, it's like, those are really my dreams come true. Like, those are the things that, you know, if I can't do that, then why am I doing it at all? You know? So, can't wait to do more. I can't wait to, you know, I don't know. Like, I always tell the story about Oprah Winfrey, like giving away cars. And I was like, that's the only time in my life I've ever been jealous of somebody, because I want to be able to do things like that. And that was one of the reasons, like if I ever felt shitty on a day, it would be because, you know, my mom maybe needed something and I was like 35 and I was waiting tables. I felt like at that age, I should be able to do for my family and provide in ways that I didn't have the agency or capacity to do because I didn't have any money. And so, you know, they say when you acquire wealth, you kind of become more of who you already are. And so that's something that I look forward to doing. But so Breonna Taylor, her painting was one of the most special paintings I've ever done outside of Michelle. I think I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to participate in that moment and codify, you know, like the year 2020 in a real way, historically speaking, that we can look back at that and remember the complexity of the moment. And for most of that year, I wanted to get out and do something, but I couldn't because I'm immune suppressed because I had a heart transplant and I was just nervous about getting COVID. There weren't any vaccines yet. And so, you know, I stayed home and I played it safe, but I feel lucky that my art was the opportunity to participate in a bigger way outside of, you know, walking in the streets. And
yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was on the cover of the September issue of Vanity Fair. So, and it was obviously shared widely across social media and news everywhere. And not only did you donate this money, it established two programs in Breonna Taylor's name forever.
Yeah.
And that just shows the generosity that you have. And that's beautiful. So thank you for doing that. That's amazing. I want to ask about like the auction situation that happens now, that happens commercially with many artists, and especially for you, where work does suddenly end up at auction and sells for considerable amounts of money. And I know that you've been quite vocal about how that makes you feel, and many artists are going through that. And this, you know, the fact that artists don't get any resale money from this, they don't benefit from that. And how is that for you at the moment? And is this the conversations that you have with a gallery about placing work? I know lots of works go straight to institutions, which is amazing, but when they enter private collections, are these things that you didn't ever think you'd have to consider and are now a big consideration for you?
Yeah, I always thought about auctions. Even before I had a gallery, or, you know, when I was like five paintings deep into, like, you know, making these grayscale paintings. Because I remember needing money and wanting to sell something, but then also having that, you know, kind of dream in the back of my head that was going to become a reality. And I was really careful about that and not just, you know, just selling work just because I can. You know what I mean? You know, I always tell my students, it's like, sell enough so that you can make more work. But you have to remember that if you're just out there, you know, selling paintings for $3,000, $4,000 early on in your career, because you can and it's exciting and it feels really good. But if you make it big, it's going to be, I feel like it's going to be your worst nightmare. You know what I mean? Because once a tipping point is created, like the sale of the Bathers was kind of like a tipping point that was created when it sold for $4.2 million or whatever it was. At that point, I was like just waiting, you know, because I was like, the next one is coming. And I knew it was going to be from like collectors early on who like kind of technically aren't really collectors, right? Because they couldn't walk into a gallery now and get a painting because of like the system that they have set up within the gallery world. So yeah, I, you know, but at the end of the day, it's part of the ecosystem, I guess. And it's just how things work. I would have hoped that by this point that some things would have changed. Mm. But I don't know if it's the same. I mean, sometimes I think about that and I'm like, you know, it's the younger artists that are really affected by it. Because if you have a collector that sold a painting for so much money and you're still struggling to pay your rent, then like that's kind of like a horrible thing, you know? And you always just hope that they do the right thing and go through the gallery. So like, fine, resell it, make money, but let's just try to make it a wholesome transaction of sorts. You know, it sucks to like, one, like not even know where the piece is, you know?
Yeah.
It's like somebody bought it. They want it to be private. Some Chinese billionaire could own it. I don't know.
But for people listening, there's a process set up. It's called flipping, when someone buys an artwork and then sells it auction for a higher price. But there is an art world kind of acceptance that you place the work back through the gallery that represents the artist, so that there is a controlled resale. There's documentation of where that work is going. There is money going back to the gallery and going back to the artist. So that as a system has been established that we all hope most people will follow.
Yeah, and sometimes people get divorced or they lose their job or they have something. Yeah, exactly. So there are reasons why, but I think the thing is about being responsible and being honest and transparent and kind of kind to the artist and to the gallery. You know, it's a kind of just a way of being a human being, really.
But also, and how I think do you like get
the
your
first? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you talk. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say the first piece that went, you know, he was a big collector. He had a huge collection, like a warehouse full of work. But when he died, his kids were like, "Art, meh." And so they ended up selling and auctioning off everything. And so, you know, even though there's collectors out there with good intention, like you never know whether your family is going to, you know, want to make sure that your legacy as a collector lives on.
Yeah.
How do you get your head around the fact that a painting that you made has sold for so much money, for 4.5 million? Does that blow your mind, or is that how do you calculate that in your mind?
I try not to think about it. Like when it was happening, people were texting me and I'm like working because I had a show coming up, and I try to just be really like, what's the word? I just try not to care. I don't know whether that makes sense or not. I just try not to care, you know, because it's out of my control. It's fascinating. And in a way, I guess you could feel flattered by it. Like there's these like two people battling it out to the very end.
It's complimentary. It's definitely. Yeah.
But I just, you know, I try to wake up the next day and just like put it behind me, to be
make
honest.
Make some toast. Yeah.
Absolutely. And make some toast. in the present moment with your work. Yeah. I've heard you reference lots of different cultural influences while you're making your work, like in the background. I know you do a lot of reading, and I've heard different authors mentioned, but also people like Reese Witherspoon, and how you sort of liked the interiority of her, because she was someone, when she did Election, that early movie, I was obsessed with her and the way that she would present a bit like the people you're painting, like this interior world and the battle that she would have with her characters. It's fascinating. Who have you been listening to or watching or, you know, reading during the making of your new work?
A lot of people. I have to say that I waited on Reese Witherspoon back
Did
when
you?
I was like 24 or 23. I think she might have been filming Sweet Alabama.
Was she nice?
She came and she was really nice.
Did she tip?
She doesn't. I don't even remember.
I'm sure she did.
You'd
remember if she hadn't. You'd remember if she hadn't.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, she must have been filming Sweet Alabama. But outside of that, I was just, you know, Legally Blonde was like my movie, you know, and I always give that example of like growing up watching that and being able to identify with, you know, her character. And just wanting that same reciprocity as a Black woman and how we live in the world. Mm. I use her as an example of that. Funny enough, I mean, I'm like everyone else. I listen to a lot of criminal podcasts.
Yeah.
I do. I've been watching Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
As far as reading, there's this guy named Kevin Kwashi, and I'm totally obsessed with him and everything he writes. And he just came out with a new book called Utopia. And he talks about Black aliveness. And I'm only on the first chapter. because I read at nighttime now and I fall asleep. I'm like, it takes me a year to get through the book. But let's see, what else? I listen to a lot of books. I mean, honestly, like what I'm listening to when I'm making work is like got nothing to do with the work. Cause like I just started listening to Harry Potter this year. Like I run out of podcasts to listen to, and somebody was like, you should try Harry Potter. So, oh, my assistant said that, and I started listening to Harry Potter.
Stephen Fry reading that, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think because I work so much for half of the year, like 7 days a week, usually 10-hour days, I'm really into just like escaping. So Downton Abbey, like just, you know, just stuff that makes you feel good.
And are you an Anglophile?
I am.
Good. Good news. So the London show is quite a big deal then for that front as well. You're in Mayfair in London for an Anglophile. That's like amazing.
It's funny. Yeah. So
what do you snack on in the studio? Do you eat while you're making work?
I do. I eat salt and vinegar chips with hot sauce on them.
Do you? With hot sauce?
Yeah. It's usually by the end of every deadline, my blood pressure is like on the higher side.
Do you pour it into the bag and then like shake it around?
I have like a Tupperware container and I put the chips in and I dump it and I shake it up. By the time I get to the crumbs though, I'm putting it in the bag and it's there. Oh.
Yes, love this. That's the best answer we've ever had. I love this.
And ice cream. And I have this special water. I went to LA when I was in LA the last time for my show. I went to Air One. You guys know that? Like, no. It's kind of like a Whole Foods, but it's in LA, so it's cooler. And they had this water in there that was oxygenated, and it was like $12 for a liter or something. And I liked it so much, I started ordering it by the case. So I drink my oxygenated water because I think it makes me smarter. And
that's your extravagant moment. We love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love. So anyway, we're going to get into our last questions now. But you are an absolute joy. So we ask every guest that comes on, if you could do an art heist and you could have any work of art in the world for your own collection to live with, what would it be and why?
I want to say it'd be a piece by Anselm Kiefer. I love his work so much. It's like the first time I saw it, I was in Chelsea, probably in grad school, and it felt like a spiritual experience. Almost if like, you know, I don't know, because it feels like an artifact, and but it feels very like God made it almost, you know what I mean? Like it's just got this.
Well, the scale as well of them works.
Yeah, the scale.
They don't make sense how they're on the wall.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. It's so fascinated by his work. So I think I would steal one of those guys.
They're I remember a story well, I was so. Told when I was studying history of art. Apparently restorers have a real nightmare with his work because often there are like live animals within the wood, and there was a museum somewhere, which I won't actually name, so I know which museum it was, that actually had a problem where the insects kind of left the work and like went into the air conditioning system or something like that. Yeah, it was quite a wild story. But they really are like, when you say like they're made by God, it's like, it's kind of like nature at its best. But it just makes me laugh, the idea that like museums are so, you know, highly controlled with the temperature and all of these things. I just love the idea that his work is alive. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color? Which I thought, you know, if you think back to Panama with every room that had different colors, maybe that might have inspired it.
Well, this year it's, what color? It's like a burnt orange.
This year? It changes every year.
I don't know if it changes every year, but it used to be gray, but not because of the skin color or anything, but like I just love gray. It went from like maybe orange when I was a child to like army green maybe when I was like in my 20s or whatever, to gray, to now it's like a burnt orange color.
Mm. Does that enter the work a lot? Yeah,
it has. It has in one painting. And I kept that painting because it's my favorite color. So I didn't sell that painting. But that color and mint green. So I made a painting where the background was mint green and the dress is like this brownish burned orange color. And those are my two favorite colors together.
Are there any parts of the painting that you really dread? Some artists say they hate doing feet. Some hate doing hands. Some hate doing the horizon. Are there any bits that you're like, oh, God, here we go. I'm stuck on this for a while. I mean, we interviewed Caroline Walker and she paints hospital scenes and she says that there would be like a curtain and she'd be like, oh, my God, I'm stuck on this curtain now, this green curtain that I have to now paint for X amount of hours, but I have to do it. And why do I do this to myself?
I mean, sometimes I don't feel like painting clothes.
Oh.
Which is crazy because I have to paint clothes. I said after I finish these motorcycles, I don't ever want to paint a motorcycle again. Mm-hmm.
But you've done two, yeah.
But I've done two. Maybe, I don't know, it's either grass or like, if it's just the figures, then I don't have one. But my, well, actually my least favorite thing to paint on a figure is like the clavicle.
Mm.
I hate painting the clavicle.
The collarbone.
The collarbone, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, it takes me longer than it should. It doesn't make any sense because it's like barely there. And I think that's why it's so hard, because it's like barely there and it's so nuanced. But painting the collarbone, it gets on my goddamn nerves.
Interesting. Never heard.
So we're going to see we're hardly going to see the collarbone then. Most of the characters will be high shirted, high collared, or the area sort of covered over.
Now you know.
Oh, that's great.
How do you title your works, just before we wrap up? Because one of my favorite paintings by you is the steel girder one, which has got a kind of, it's almost like a reference, well, it is a reference to the Charles Ebbett's famous 1932 photograph of a construction beam kind of high in the air with this amazing figure sat on a green, I just love that color green. It's so rich. But the title for that work is so beautiful. It's If You Surrendered to the Air, You Could Ride It. From 2019. Yep. Like, and it got me thinking about words and like how you title your paintings, because that's just one of the best titles for one of the best paintings like ever.
Yeah, that one is actually a line from a Toni Morrison book. So many times I have named a few myself, but you know, I'm a visual person, so that's, you know, that's my thing. But I read a lot of poetry, and just in reading, I find, you know, sentences that are parts of sentences that just fit. And I may not even have the painting made, but I know that it would make a great title for something. So I write it down and I keep it. But I use a lot of Black female writers in the beginning, like maybe the last show, I think maybe Toni Morrison and Gwendolyn Brooks, Lucille Clifton, poets, David White, who's also one of my favorite poets, but mostly through poetry and reading, I like collect words and sentences and piece them together, change them around some way. And my sister sometimes names them for me.
Oh, really?
Your sister?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
She was really good at it for like the first 5 years, but lately she's been off. So like she's her feelings are hurt because I didn't like any of them. But maybe she'll get the magic back soon. But lately it's just been me and my poetry.
Well, so she would come into the studio and you'd be like, right, you can name this one. What do you think? And she'd come up
with
something.
I would send her like progress pictures over the phone, and she would come back. Like she named Miss Everything.
Yeah.
That's
the one, the National Portrait Gallery Prize. Yeah. One. Yeah.
Yeah. She named Innocent You, Innocent Me. So many, like she named a lot of them. Yeah. Like from 2014 to let's say 2019, she named a lot of them.
Nice.
It's good to work, you know, it's like, it's good to keep it in the family and, you know, we have something business. We can share together. Yeah.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your work?
I don't know.
Or the advice that you would give.
Oh yeah, you can turn
artist.
It on his head. Yeah.
Yeah. My advice is to simply never quit. If you want it, go for it. Always check with somebody who you can trust to make sure you're not living a pipe dream. Like you have the skill, but just never quit. Because I always say the world is full of quitters. So eventually you rise to the top. Like, had I given up at 35, when I was like, I could have been like, oh, I'm 35 now. I shouldn't be doing this anymore. I need to try to find a quote unquote real job. Then I would have never had the opportunity to paint, you know, the first African-American first lady. I mean, you know, it's just, you really just have to stay focused on what you want in your life and never stop pursuing it.
Thank God you didn't. Are we going to see a Venus and Serena Williams painting? You sort of hinted at that earlier that you wanted to, if that was the commission you were considering.
I don't know if they would let me. I certainly would, though.
Love, right, we're putting that out there. Putting that out
I tried
there.
To like, I like saw Serena at the LACMA Gala and I was like, hey, by the way, if I wasn't going to paint Michelle, like I was going to choose you. But I don't think she knew who I was.
Right. You've got to manifest like, it, Amy, and it will happen.
Maybe
manifest
she listens to Talk happen. Art. You never know. She might hear it.
You're in a crowd of people and you're like, it's just somebody else is trying to say something to me right now. So.
Right.
But,
that's
yeah.
really funny.
I think they're powerful. I think they're so powerful.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Incredible.
Extraordinary
what
human beings. We
what they've
them.
Done for incredible. Tennis and women in sports is amazing.
Yeah. Mm.
Thank you so much for being so generous and open and just like you are with your work. It's been such a privilege to meet you because Russ and I wanted to meet you when we first started the podcast all those years ago in 2018. So like
yeah, we,
to finally
we were DMing.
Be here with you. Yeah, we love yeah. you so much. And
I was
I
running
also...
from you, Russell. I was so like so burned out from like that whole year I was like running from you.
Yeah,
we've really caught running, up we've like... caught you now. We've trapped you into the tall cart lair. You're in. But no, thank you so much. So your upcoming show The World We Make will be opening in October the 12th, is it?
Yeah, and it runs until the 23rd of December. So great. It goes all the way up until Christmas. And it's free to get into. It's in the center of London. And there's really small scale paintings alongside monumental portraits. So you get a kind of real, you know, view of all the different kinds of work that Amy makes. And it's the first ever exhibition in Europe. So make sure you see it. And you're coming over to London, aren't you, for the opening?
Yes, I'll be in London town on Thursday. Awesome. After tomorrow.
Well, we will make sure we come to the opening and give you a big hug.
Seriously? Amazing.
Yeah.
You'll run away from us.
You will run away.
Run away from you.
Thank you so much, Amy Sherald. And you're on Instagram. And by the way, you're also a style icon in my eyes because I love the knitwear you have. I love your style. Generally, I'm a big, big fan of you sartorially. Yeah, so you can follow Amy. Your Instagram's at Amy Sherald.
Yeah, it's at A. Sherald.
A. Sherald.
The letter A and then S-H-E-R-A-L-D.
Cool.
Amazing.
And you can also go to at Houserworth and houserworth.com and just Google.
And then you can at George and Wheezy Official, my dogs.
Oh, of course. We talked about that. I mean, for me, as soon as I discovered that you had George and Wheezy's Instagram, I was locked in. That's it. You're just the best ever. Anyone who has a dog Instagram for me is an icon.
He doesn't like me because I've got a cat Instagram. I just got kittens. And you can follow my kittens at window and doorway.
Are we plugging
and
the kittens?
I let them out today. I let them out today into the whole house and they've been running around through this interview. All I can hear is like people, like, not people, sorry, kittens like running by the door the whole way through the interview. It's hilarious.
I just fostered two kittens for a week I found in the parking lot of my studio. It was crazy. They're so sweet. I wish I could have kept them.
Oh, you're not keeping them? The dog?
No.
Wheezy. Yeah. Buster and Wheezy won't like them.
I mean, I live in a condo. We can only have we have the max dogs. It's three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my partner, Kevin, is like, no. Like,
no cats as well.
You're always trying to save something, Amy. Like, we're not going to keep these cats.
It's great to be a foster, though. I think fostering animals is a brilliant thing. And the RSPCA in the UK do great work with that. Thank you so, so much. Can't wait to see you in London. And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.